The first half of this first hour is with Ole Domagard. He's in Warsaw, Poland right now, attending Exposing the Truth conference there. And the second half of the first hour here is with Tony Gosling. He's going to bring us up to date on several things and about the snap election in UK and so forth. But hold on and listen to us and hang in there, and we'll give you some insight. Thank you for listening. Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Along with me this evening is one of the finest guests I've ever interviewed. In fact, we met in Copenhagen, and he was preaching love for thy neighbor, and I was preaching forgive thy neighbor. Welcome to our program, Ole Domagard.
Thank you so much, George. It's a real pleasure and honor.
Well, I tell you what, you are very an honor to be around and to even speak with about these subjects of freedom and liberty and so forth. And tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and give us a little bit of your experience and life experience.
Okay. I've been... what can I say? I was born in Denmark, grew up in Sweden, have moved around in a lot in the world. I've traveled to some 40 different countries, and the last 30 odd years I've spent trying to find out what's really going on behind the scenes. And I focused in the areas of false flag operations and top political assassinations, since the way I see it is these areas are the areas that are being used as very violent tools against our freedom and against the way they deal with us. And so at the moment I've been on a mini tour, sort of. I live in Spain, but the last few days here, or the last week, I've been to four different countries. I've been to Estonia, Sweden, Denmark, and I'm now in Poland, in Warsaw, giving talks and lectures about trying to expose what is behind all of these alleged terror attacks that are happening in Europe, and also the mass shootings in the US, which in my humble opinion are all coordinated, and all of them inside jobs. So this whole thing about Allah Akbar, I tell you, absolutely not true. State-sponsored terrorism, that's the name of the game.
Right. Gladio seems to come to my mind over the years. And, of course, there's a lot of different facets of that. Is there not?
Yeah, for sure. Gladio is very, very important to understand. It was a ghost army that was created by NATO and the CIA after the Second World War in the early 50s. And to start with, it was meant as a secret weapon against an invasion from the east. But then when the threat from Russia sort of diminished, they sort of, what are we going to do with all of these, this ghost army that nobody was aware of, which was consisted of like many, many thousands of hard warriors and so on. And then somebody came up with the idea, the strategy of tension, let's inflict some fear in modern society so that the population will accept more and more military control and surveillance and all of these type of things. And so this is, I believe, very strongly what we're seeing now are these alleged terror attacks, all of them carried out in NATO countries or countries that are very close to NATO, all with the agenda of random violence in the form of alleged terror attacks, airplane crashes, train crashes, accidents, but also many, many so-called alleged crimes, you know, violent crimes and so on. It's carried out by the same forces just to create mayhem and chaos so that we will just beg for more and more protection.
Right. Now, the conference there is exposing the truth in Warsaw. And you're one of the keynote speakers, if not one of the honored speakers. Of what, four speakers a day, basically, is all you're having there, something like that?
Yeah, true. And, well, there's,
and how was the response today to what you were, what basically, how did, what did you speak about today at the conference, basically?
I speak about false flag terrorism, and okay. The false flag means that it's, the one that is seems like being attacked, that they're actually attacking themselves, turning into a victim, and then that would justify whatever means they have to sort of force their will on the rest of us. And the thing is, nowadays it's come to a point where these things are not even real attacks anymore, but they're staged events, just like a film shoot, and it's just taking on proportions that it's absolutely really funny when you start looking at it and how badly they're carried out. So it starts out really dramatic when I give a talk, and in the end people are just falling over laughing because it's just so bizarre and ridiculous, really. So I'm being welcomed everywhere, you know, because people are longing for being liberated from this fear that they feel, and when I show what's actually going on, it sort of breaks the spell that is keeping us in slavery. And so once you see what actually is going on, that it's an illusion,
right,
of terror, that it's an illusion of an enemy, then you start seeing the fog lifting, and you will start noticing who's really behind it, how few we are, how many we are, and that we can't expect anyone else to do it for us. We need to wake up. We need to take the power back, but also transcend this whole thing in a totally nonviolent way.
Yeah, one mind at a time. Wake up one mind at a time, almost like winning over a heart at a time. You know?
No, focus on the one in the mirror. That's the one you should deal with. That's the only one.
I like that, Ole. Solzhenitsyn said, "The battle line between good and evil runs through every human heart."
It does, and the longest road to travel is the one from the brain down to the heart.
I like that. Man, that's cool. That's cool, Ole. You know, the but it begins with one inch at a time.
It does. If you don't know what else to do, start purifying
yourself.
Mind,
yes.
Start letting go of fear, and yeah, because it's only through fear that they can control us. So that is why they need to. If they're in war times, it's easy to point at the enemy, but in peaceful times, they need to create them. So they have their own boogeyman, like Al Qaeda. Then got upgraded to ISIS. I mean, overnight, suddenly it was the biggest threat the world had ever seen.
Right. Right. So they have to control one
total fabrication. Boogeyman.
Right. Right. They have to scare us one person at a time, don't they, huh? You know, I mean,
this is the thing.
Go ahead.
No, this is the thing. Without fear, if we are not fearful, if they say burr and we don't bend over, they have a major problem. So the thing, if you don't know what else to do, then focus on letting go of fear. You know, when the next time something awful happens, ask yourself, who benefits from me believing this? Who benefits from me becoming afraid? And what is it, the solution they're serving us? Because nowadays, with a concentration span like a turtle, you're like, they need to serve it very quickly because we have time. We will just change channels and so on. So something bad happens, then you'll see a reporter interview somebody, a witness. Now understand, the witness is very often part of the operation, and so is the reporter. So the
Right. So
what happened?
So a lot.
The witness was there.
Go ahead.
Well, it was awful. There was all these dead bodies, and it was. Sorry, you broke
up.
Yeah,
could you cut off your video? Maybe that might help a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just there again. Okay. Now that's better. I think we'll have a cleaner connection that way. So what you're saying is many times. Yeah. When these false flag operations are run, there'll be a witness that will step forward and start describing the scene, right? And sometimes they're involved in the false flag, right?
Most of the time you will see that the witnesses that are being interviewed, once you start checking them right. off, they will belong to one or three different groups. They will be either connected somehow to the government or media. Or film or theater. These are the three. Sometimes sports as well.
Right.
But these are the groups. And
I've got Tony Gosling ringing in. Do you want to bring him in with us?
If you want to.
Yeah. Properly.
Oh, don't worry.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we'll leave that off. But anyway, you've written.
No,
okay. Go ahead.
I just want to say when they carry these. Operations now, it's very important to understand it's not only what is happening, but they control they by design control the different steps, you know, everything from the crime scene to the media to the hospital to the investigation and to commissions that will follow up, and often the Patsy as well is totally in their control, so they control all parameters, including crisis actors and directors, marketing agencies. They even have product placement campaigns where they put different products in the center of this terror, because that is when we're totally open emotionally, that is a really good time to just shove a Coca-Cola bottle in there to make people crave it and so on. So it's very cold and cynical, this business.
Well, it's now many a times they do this to tension the countries that they're operating in, and to what tension the public at large a lot of times.
Yeah, for sure. And I believe, this is a theory of mine, but I believe,
okay.
If you remember a few years ago, we had what is called the Arab Spring, where a series of North African countries were destabilized, and where there were so-called revolutions, and a new president took over. But now it's been more and more apparent that there were CIA and other intelligence agencies behind funding, stirring the energy, getting provocateurs in there, and then replacing the person in power with their own puppet. And what I think is what we're seeing now in Western Europe is what I call the Eurospring, where they do the exact same thing, but with Europe instead, by circulating and recycling terror in the same countries. It's going round and round in a circle, repeating itself to just... It's like being up against Mike Tyson, where he's just keeping jab, 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 you know, so that we can't focus, that we are totally out of balance and cannot concentrate to find out the truth of one thing before the next thing happens.
Oh, okay. My gosh, it's getting to where some of it's pretty transparent to an investigator, though, is it not? It's becoming too obvious at times.
You know, the title of my talk is Terror, Are You Kidding Me?
Say again?
That's the title.
You're doing what?
Terror, Are You Kidding Me?
Okay. Okay, you seem to be...
Because it's...
Yeah,
sorry?
You're dropping out on me sometimes on your audio. Yeah.
Okay, so then the title of my lecture now is Terror, Are You Kidding Me?
Okay.
Because it's almost like a joke now, the way they're carried out. I've been able to predict four big ones 1 month before they happen. You know, I've been out on international radio. The last one was in London, where I went out more or less exactly 1 month before it happened, saying the next target, I suspect, will be Big Ben. And boom, there it happened. And the reason why I've been able to do this is because they have to, according to their way of believing things, they have to leave clues about the upcoming, next upcoming event.
Right.
It is I've had insiders explain this to me, and they say that the way the members of the New World Order see the law of karma, the way they understand it, is that if they don't, or if they show us, even in subtle ways, what they're up to, and we do not react, then the bad karma will be on our shoulders, not theirs.
Oh, okay.
So it is extremely important for them to put clues in the evidence. So once I understood that, it's been a matter of finding it. Where is it?
I see. In other words, they're setting up a series of evidentiary types of clues, and you can pick out those clues, and that will project into the future as to the actual event, right?
Yeah, it's like a Dan Brown novel, you know, where one chapter ends with a clue for the next. It's exactly like that.
Okay. That's very, very interesting. I know you were, I heard one of your interviews about the London, and that thing was just, man, the actual event was like a stage play, you know, out there. You know?
They're more or less all of them are, you know, and the script is the same.
Right.
I tell you, every single time you hear Allah Akbar, that's one of them.
Right, you know? Right.
I can tell you what the script is, and it's just like describing a Rocky film, you know. It's Rocky 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's the same theme, but a different bad guy. And it's the same with these false flags. So there will be somebody, a lone crazy guy or a lone fanatic, that will scream Allah Akbar. The reason why they want him alone is because then by law there's no conspiracy. And then if he dies, then case closed right away. The reason why they want him crazy or fanatic, if he's fanatic, then that explains why he does it. And you don't have to look at any alternative motive. Or if he's crazy, then no motive at all. He just did it. Then you will have a drill. There's always a drill before these things go down. And the drill is there so that they can get vehicles in position, close off streets, get cameras in position, smoke bombs, explosives, crisis actors, catering, makeup facilities, all of these things in position, and then rehearse the thing, but without us interfering. That is why they will go out. They need to go out and make advertisements about it on local radio or whatever, saying, tomorrow we're going to have a security drill in your blah, 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 for your protection. Right. Sometimes, yes. Many times, not. Absolutely not. They are there for them to get in position. And then that goes from a practice and into a live event. So the drills is one major clue that will help us track them down. Then they always aim at victims from multiple nations, that is to involve as many nations emotionally as possible. Now also the Patsy will have double citizenship, that is also to involve even more nations. So if there's like 14 dead people, you will have maybe 11 different nationalities and so on. Then there will be an investigation that will, the only thing they will do is point towards the Patsy. If we do not buy that one, then after a while they will put a commission there. And the commission, just like the investigation, is part of the crime. It's only there to make an illusion of democracy, an illusion that somebody's actually doing something. But then they will drag it out for at least a year before they release about, inches of documents that say absolute nothing, but it's there for us to get bored to tears so that we will not have the energy to look into it. And if we don't buy that one, they will just put another commission on top of it, and they continue to let until we give up.
Right. They re-indoctrinate, or they reiterate, or they recontaminate the public's minds, right, through this propaganda, repeating it. Story after story, repeat the story, this happened. And then a lot of writers will come in without even investigating and just be parrots on the whole thing, right?
that's the thing. We're so easily cheated, you know. We're so easily played.
Right.
And the whole, just like you say, you need to go back to the crime scene and see what actually happened, because many of the things that follows on the fake, the official version. You know, investigators start tracking down the patsy, his background, his involvement with different terror groups and so on. Absolutely, totally not interesting or true, because he had nothing to do with it, because it was an inside job blamed on this individual. And many times this individual they blame it on doesn't even exist. They're phantom identities.
Well, you're sounding more like a London detective at times, a Scotland Yard detective, and looking and being a journalist. Is that sort of what's happening?
No, the difference is that Scotland Yard doesn't do their job. Well, they are involved.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying, you're becoming the Scotland Yard. Huh?
I know, and it is exactly true. I'm not a journalist. I am doing what they are supposed
exactly.
to do, but they don't.
So we're beginning, as journalists, sounding like detectives.
Totally. Yeah. And the interesting thing is that I'm surrounded by people, you know, I have somebody with a doctor with more than 30 years of experience in different things. I've got crime detectives. I've got forensic experts.
Oh, yeah. Officers. Okay.
So I can, you know, I started doing my own podcast, which is going to go live here in the middle of May. And one of the things that I do is I have like one or two of these experts in an interview, filmed interview. And then I just show different images of, for instance, the car that is said to have killed all these people in London. And just please have a look at the dents and damages to this vehicle. What has caused it? And they will then describe that this is from a crash from another vehicle, you know, this and that. And the speed must have been this and this. And then they say, so where is it from? And I say, it's from London. It only hit pedestrians. They say, absolutely not. That is totally impossible.
Right.
I have people with ambulance drivers and fire brigade and so on. I say, you look at this one. Is this the way you park ambulances? They said you would be fired the minute you do it. I mean, that is to block the whole thing off. Is that the way you treat a stab wound? Absolutely not. Is that a real body? Absolutely not. So it's not things that I am trying to persuade people to believe. I have experts having a look at it without knowing what they're looking at, and I hope that will give a lot more credibility to the whole thing.
So you're bringing in experts that you've gained friendships with from all over the web, all over the world, right?
Yeah, and they're not beginners, I tell you. Cyril Weck, you know, the guy that came up with more or less the magic bullet theory, one of the major critics of the JFK assassination, involved in the autopsy of Elvis, Michael Jackson, Nicole Smith, James Earl Ray, and so on. People like that, you know, Barbara Honegger, and so on. I mean, heavy, heavy weights.
Right, right. I've been at many seminars with a lot of those people, of course, and we were up in Dallas in November up there together. And you spoke very eloquently up there. I missed you on the interview. I'm sorry about that. But we'll get makeup for it, Ole. We've got to get on the air some more, me and you. We both have, I have 35 years experience in these different areas, you know? So.
That is so true. And anytime you want me on, please. Let's do some real important stuff.
Yeah,
together.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do some extended things. Otherwise, I know you have a show coming up here in a second?
No, the show is for me to try and sleep. I haven't slept I've been to four different countries in 10 days.
Oh, okay. Well, look, I'm going to let you go then. I know you need to get some rest and everything. But I certainly do appreciate the report this evening, you know?
Anytime.
And thank you very much, Ole Damgaard from Warsaw, Poland. We certainly appreciate your hard work. And we know that you're a light for freedom in the world. We know that.
I am indeed. My website is called Light on Conspiracies as well, because that is what I try to aim the light into the darkest of the dark corner, into the belly of the beast. And it's Light of Conspiracies because even though the power structure behind them is only small and one, more or less, there's so many of these conspiracies.
Right. You've got a wonderful site. We'll have that up on the, we have that up already on our website on this broadcast. So we want to thank you again and more. Get some sleep, okay?
Thank you so much, George. So
thank you, Ole. Good night. Bye bye.
You take care.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Along with me is Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. Welcome, Tony.
Hi, George. Well, I'm actually not in Bristol today. I'm up in sleepy Stroud in Gloucestershire. Stroud is one of the cradles of the Industrial Revolution. In fact, it's one of the first places in Britain, along with the Peak District and Matlock in Derbyshire, where the very first factories were ever. You know, the dark satanic mills. This whole area is covered. If anyone ever visits Britain, I say don't miss Gloucestershire and the Cotswolds, because this is where things like weaving very first started. I mean, okay, so people were doing cottage industries. In fact, the very house that I'm in used to be an old weaver's cottage about 300-400 years ago. And what happened was that because of the water power in the rivers around here, they started realizing, well, we can harness that water power and build bigger widgets. Basically, we're talking about looms, you know, to do the weaving of the cloth for example. Pretty much every English Army uniform, British Army uniform with that old red coat, if you remember those.
Yeah, the red coats, yeah, are coming.
That's right. They were made right here in Stroud. That's called Stroud Red, that colour. And there is actually still cloth mill still operating here, which does very, very high quality cloth. Most of them have gone to other parts of the world, but there is this whole kind of heritage of this particular part of Britain, which is where the ordinary people went broke because the factories, the mills, when they sprung up in the 1700s, they could basically outperform people working in their own homes. And then we had the canals come here and later the railways, but this was this whole area was one of the first parts of the country to have canals to move things around, things like coal, all sorts of goods and commodities, and so it's a bit of a historic part of Britain. It's also well worth visiting because it's not like other parts of England in that it's lots of small farms, small farmers, lots of small herds of sheep, herds of cattle, and that sort of thing. A lot of small landowners. Rather than these big, vast farms you get in some parts of Britain, I think it's fair to say, a fairly switched-on area where a lot of people are very much aware of their history in Stroud, and it's got a bit of a reputation of a place of innovation. Things like innovative housing projects, things like that, you know, really lovely places to live, co-housing, things like that, tend to happen around here where they don't in other parts of the country. So we're a little bit away from Bristol, and it's a kind of, you could call it my country retreat.
Oh, man, you sound like you're really enjoying your weekend up there, right?
That's right, and the weather's been glorious. It's one of the first proper spring weekends we've had. All the trees are just coming out into leaf, just beginning to, and an absolutely beautiful, glorious day today, out in the beautiful surrounding countryside around here.
What about Theresa May's snap election? What the heck is that about? Tony, tell us about it. You caught laughing. What do you mean, Tony?
Well, she's playing a bit of a game, isn't she? Because the last year and a half or year or so she's been, it's a bit less than a year that she's been Prime Minister, but each time she gets asked this question, she said, no way is there going to be a snap election. Of course, she's just broken another promise there, along with many of the other promises that our politicians are always seem to be breaking once they're into power. This is a bit like Trump, isn't it? Make lots of lovely promises in the run-up to the election, but then afterwards that all gets sort of torn up and thrown away in the waste paper bin.
Exactly.
The real reason for this, a lot of people scratching their heads, of course, the official Conservative line is, well, you know, we're ahead in the polls, or we just think it would be a good idea to solidify our majority. They've already got a majority, George. They don't really need to do that. They've got a majority of 17, the Conservatives, in the House of Commons. And so a lot of people are scratching their heads, say, well, hang on a minute, since you've already got a majority, what exactly is this really all about? And so, I mean, the other parties are relishing this. Of course, Jeremy Corbyn is going to get his first chance to prove, to see whether he can be Prime Minister, which it will be an interesting experience, since it's got to be pointed out again and again and again. Jeremy Corbyn is the first Prime Minister material or opposition leader we've had in Britain since the heady days of 1976. Every Labour leader since, and any other kind of Prime Minister, Blair, for example, they have all been, you know, kind of lined up with the neocons, what we call Blairites now here in Britain. And that's even James Callaghan, who was took over when Wilson resigned in the 1970s. There hasn't actually really been an independent-minded leader of the opposition. So we've had that continuity ever since 1976 of the British equivalent of neocons, that's effectively the City of London elite running the country. And Corbyn is completely not that kind of guy. I mean, you know, I'm not sure whether he has much of a chance of winning or not. I think it's possible that on the 8th of June that we will see Corbyn become Prime Minister. But there's been lots of interesting stuff going on here since. Number one, I would say, absolutely number one, is that Theresa May is refusing to do any TV debates with the other party leaders, particularly with Jeremy Corbyn. Now, this could sink her campaign completely, because what the broadcasters here are talking about, George, is by empty seating her.
Really?
Okay. So you'll have a TV debate with an empty chair saying this is where Theresa May should be, but she's not there.
My gosh. My gosh.
So that is going, it will really affect the vote. You know, when people see that she hasn't got the courage of her convictions, they're very likely to not vote for her. Yeah, so this could be actually the glug, glug, glug sound of her campaign and her party just sinking below the waves, George.
Do you think this is about Brexit and she's going to avoid that big decision? You think this is it?
Well, look, we're being told it's all to do with Brexit. They need a better majority. They've already got a majority, George. They don't need a better majority. They've got a set majority of 17. Look, I'm come to... So, I mean, we've got this number one. If the Prime Minister of the day, Theresa May, she was never actually elected to the job. She was one of the running... in the running after David Cameron left. But the person who she was supposed to have an election with, Andrea Leadsom, stepped aside. She didn't stand. So Theresa May got a bye. So she's never actually been elected to be the leader of the Conservative Party. There's 120,000 members of the Conservative Party across Britain who've had absolutely no say whatsoever in choosing her as their party leader. So, you know, this is an elite choice. They chose her. The city elite chose Theresa May. So this fact that she won't stand up in the TV debates, it really does. There's a lot of British people that simply will not vote for her as a result of that. But yes, okay, let's get on to what this election is really about, because there's a big question marks over, is it really anything to do with Brexit, because she's got a majority,
right,
now.
Exactly.
Let me tell you, we've had since the 2015 election in this country, when David Cameron was elected with a Conservative majority, and the after the previous coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, in 2015, May 2015, there were several accusations across the country, in Scotland too, of election fraud. Okay, so that is to say, not submitting the correct election returns, which spell out all your election expenses. Now, this is taken very seriously in the legislation in Britain that governs elections, called the Representation of the People Act. And there are several of them, but the most recent, I think, is in the 1990s. So these Acts of Parliament govern very, very carefully the amount of money you're allowed to spend in a general election. In any election, in fact, but specifically in a general election, which we had in 2015. Now, these rules are pretty strict, George. Not like in the US, you can spend pretty much what you want. You know, if, for example, Goldman Sachs decides that they're going to give $1 billion to a candidate, you know, that's quite allowed, you know. But over here, you're not allowed to do that sort of thing. And particularly when it comes to marginal seats. So, say, for example, there's a and the first past the post system we've got here, if you've got a seat where Labour and Conservative have been nearly neck and neck in the previous election, what will happen is both parties will throw everything they've got at that seat, knowing that just by a few votes, you know, they can win it. So what happened in 2015 is various parties cheated a little bit on their elections. Now, okay, so we've already had prosecution of Scottish Nationalists. We've had prosecution of UK Independence Party. Only one or two, and only small amounts. The same with the Labour Party. Small prosecution of the Labour Party. But by far the biggest offenders, George, were the Conservatives at the 2015 election. Channel 4 News, along with The Canary, which is an online newspaper based in Bristol, did a whole load of research on how much money had been spent in specific constituencies, marginal constituencies, by the Conservatives. And you know what they found? They found that there are nearly 30 Conservative MPs that could be prosecuted, possibly even jailed, for submitting false expenses. Now, it's taken a long time for this to chug its way through the British legal system, nearly 2 years, but that, I think, is one of the main reasons why the Conservatives have decided they need to call a general election, because they might find, when it comes to June, when these prosecutions are due to be announced by June, that they may have lost their majority, because not because of a by-election, but because their members of Parliament have been arrested and have been put in jail.
Oh, my God. Boy, isn't that scandalous, huh?
Well, it's unbelievable, but it's true. And the Crown Prosecution Service have said that they will announce what's going to happen to these 30 MPs and to the various agents associated with those elections back in 2015 before the date of this general election. So it looks as if this is going to form some kind of part of the election, the pre-election campaign. So everyone's keeping their eyes on what the Crown Prosecution Service is saying. But there is another side to all of this, and that is in the opposition Labour Party. You've got, really, it's like the Judean People's Front versus the People's Front of Judea, the Labour Party. And if you've seen the famous Monty Python film, The Life of Brian, you'll know exactly what I mean, that you've got these various left-wing factions that are fighting each other, much more than they're up fighting the Tories, which is why we've had leadership challenge to Jeremy Corbyn, which was a total flop by the Blairites. And so you've got the Blairites in the Labour Party causing all these problems. They, for example, they go on the TV and the Dimbleby or whoever it is on the presenter will say, "Hey guys, do you support Jeremy Corbyn, your leader?" And then they just try and avoid the question, you know, because they're Blairites and they don't like Corbyn. Right. So this is no way for a loyal party MP, for example, to behave. They should be saying, at the very least, "Yes, of course, we do support him," you know. So they have got all these problems going on in the Labour Party. And you know what's happened, George, over the last couple of months? The Labour Party and Corbyn, the leadership, have announced that they are going to have reselection of these MPs. So what it means is, if a local party is not happy with its MP, that its MP hasn't been endorsing Corbyn as the leader, for example, or has been undermining him by saying things like, as one of our local MPs in Bristol said, that he behaves like a cult leader, you know, which is not a complimentary thing to say about your own party leading. You're supposed to be actually attacking the Conservatives. They're not. They're attacking their own party. When Kerry McCarthy, the MP, it was that said that, there are questions amongst her local party members. Do we want her to carry on as our Member of Parliament? And we will have a chance to deselect her and have another candidate come the next election. Well, what this snap election means is that those Blairite MPs in the Labour Party will have to carry on as MPs, yeah? So they won't have a chance to have the time to do a reselection process. So it means that the Blairite MPs will get another 5 years in the Houses of Parliament in order to keep sticking the knife in Jeremy Corbyn's back, George. So that's another aspect of this which has really not been covered at all in our mainstream press here.
By God, Tony, that's really a good insight for reporting.
Well, I hope so. So that's one of the reasons. Look, let's not forget, we've got the possibility of war coming along, okay? We all know with the North Korean problem and obviously with Ukraine and with Syria, various other little places, you know, looking a little bit dodgy. The House of Parliament keeps having to do these kind of war votes, and I can tell you the Blairites are the ones that always seem to sign up, yes, we want a war. So that's another reason to try and keep these Blairite MPs in Parliament, to have this quick election so they just get re-elected.
Right.
Recently. And so if there is a war vote, then the neocons, the powers that be, can count on these old Blairite Labour MPs to back the war. Because if they were to be deselected and they were to have the more Corbynite, or can we call them Corbynistas as MPs?
Corbynistas.
Right. Corbynista MPs would be definitely voting against war. Corbyn is totally independent-minded guy. He's not backing any kind of US wars. He's very much, for example, against that the US strike on Syria, very vocal against that, saying that it was breaking international law, etc. And the only people who are backing that within the opposition Labour Party are the Blairites, and it looks like they're going to get another 5-year lease of life so they can vote for the next war when that comes along.
Right. Did the Robert Perry insider information on the drones coming in from that secret base in Jordan, was that ever verified any further, or do you know?
I haven't seen any verification of it, George. Yeah. I'm afraid. I mean, it's really difficult. I mean,
it's a difficult thing.
Sometimes people get fed bum information. You know, you just don't know. And it's been that. I mean, without him saying a bit more, giving a bit more detail, it's very difficult to stand that story up. We can talk about it, but, you know, I've been in the business of mainstream media as well, and I think it's important to have, you know, some kind of verifiable facts. When you see a so-called chemical attack on your TV, you know, you need to make sure you've got verifiable facts to do with that attack before you start launching missile attacks and spend $100 million on cruise missiles to whack an airfield.
Exactly.
So, you know, believe in standing stuff up, you know, before you start running with it too far. It's really important, I think, people understand. It doesn't mean to say you can't speculate. Of course you can. But you just have to use the correct language.
Well, I think you're right, Tony. You say when you speculate, and I try to say when I speculate or make assertions that are just opinion versus fact. So we have to do that, you know.
Another place that we need to be doing this is looking at this terrorist attack on Thursday.
Yeah.
On the Sean's.
Yeah.
Because look at the circumstances surrounding that. It's an unbelievable attack, George. First of all, it's right in the run-up to the French presidential elections. It almost seems perfectly designed to favour the nationalist right-wing Marine Le Pen. Front National candidates, you know, that this is the danger we have to face from these foreigners. No one seems to notice that this guy, his name is Karim Cherifi, 39-year-old. He was born in France, not a foreigner at all. In fact, the most amazing thing here is, I think, that he was very, very well known to the French military anti-terror police. So he is right at the top of their terrorist watch list. He's done 12 years in jail for threatening to kill police in the past. So he's like number one up the top of the list. Also, he's managed somehow to get hold of not only a Kalashnikov automatic rifle, but also shotguns and plenty of ammunition for both, it seems. He was absolutely loaded to the gunwales with the various bits of hardware, and not only that, and this is the most, I think, unbelievable aspect of this so-called terror attack, is that he posted exactly what he was about to do a couple of hours before he did it on one of these social networking websites. So if the French Deuxième Bureau have got a guy who's been threatening to kill the police, he's done 12 years in jail as a violent maniac, and they have allowed him to somehow get hold of guns and ammunition and post what he's about to do on Facebook or wherever it is before he's done it. They are the most incompetent and utterly useless Secret Service anywhere in the world.
Right. Well, you know, some of those attacks over there, you remember when the detective committed suicide, one of those terrorist attacks at his own desk? Remember?
Yeah, he's His name was Henrik Fredu.
Yeah, at his own death.
Yeah, well, I think he was a decent policeman who was doing his job. And he was starting to uncover things that didn't look very nice.
An inside job or some kind of false flag operation, who knows?
That's right. And also, look, going back, this isn't very long ago, September 2016, last year, 6 or 8 months ago, they're down in the south of France at a place called Saumur, S-A-U-M-U-R, there was a cave uncovered by local police in that town, which turned out to be an ISIS terror cell. In fact, they had a whole load of ISIS costumes, if you can call them that, kind of black garbs they wear. They had ISIS flags, you know, these proper ISIS flags. They had a whole load of ISIS propaganda literature in these caves, and the local police discovered it. A local man actually saw these guys acting suspiciously. The police went in, they found this whole terror cell hiding in this cave, little cave network in Saumur. And funnily enough, they said, it was just an exercise.
Oh my gosh, I tell you.
This is 8 months ago in Saumur in France. So we are supposed to believe that the French intelligence services need ISIS flags for their exercise. They need propaganda literature for their exercises. And that we're supposed to believe that this was all just being done by the state and there's nothing to worry about. And now look, George, you know, you as well as I know that if there is actually an exercise going on, it'd be completely normal to inform the local police in the area where you're doing your exercise, just so there is no confusion and nobody gets shot and killed. Right, so right. That's what nearly happened here. These people involved in this so-called exercise were nearly shot by the local police. Now, this story hardly got any national and virtually zero international coverage in France, but it does indicate, and this is where we start to speculate a little here.
Right,
it does indicate that the French secret services are actually running ISIS terror cells themselves.
Yeah, could
and
be.
These
yeah.
These terror cells can then be just sort of stuck into a little van, taken into a city, cause a terrorist outrage of some sort, and then you get the right-wing backlash that you're looking for. So, you know, that seems to me what's been going on in France, and the Secret Services, just like in many other countries, under Operation Gladio and NATO intelligence services, blowing up their own people and then trying to blame it on the Russians or Al-Qaeda or whoever it is, the latest enemy, that seems to be just simply what's been going on in France, and it wouldn't surprise me whatsoever if Karim Cherifi was just some kind of patsy who was designed to ramp up tensions, to have a strategy of tension in the run-up to the French presidential election by their own security forces.
Well, I tell you, it is bad, you know. But France is a large country over there. It's not going to be easy to control that country, see?
Well, I think the main thing is just to get the candidate that you want
right,
in power.
Right, right, right.
Once that happened, I mean, let's just go back to look at the Le Pen, shall we say, etymology of the family.
Yeah, the father was much more right-wing than she is, supposedly.
Right.
Yeah.
They're basically Vichy France, that family.
Right.
So they were, you know, we would call them in England, we would call them the surrender monkeys, basically. The people that decided, yeah, we're going to collaborate with the Nazis. A bit like the Quisling family up in Norway. So, you know, rather than either sort of have an attitude of non-cooperation with your occupying forces, the Nazis as they were in France then, or some kind of working in some way towards the resistance. You know, what happened was that Le Pen and the other Vichy French people were working very much with the Nazis and helping them. Now, some will say, of course, that the Vichy French were secretly against the Nazis, and that's quite true. Some of them were. But it doesn't really bode well for the. I mean, I think one thing you must say about Marine Le Pen is she does seem to have rode back on some of the more extreme policies of her father. You're right, George. But, I mean, she is by no means going to win this election. I mean, there is also this amazing guy, En Marche is his campaign slogan, which means off we go, basically. It means we're going to do something different, anything we like. In the typical French flamboyant style.
Right.
And he's a centrist candidate, Emmanuel Macron, who's come virtually from nowhere. I mean, you know, a few weeks ago was the first time I heard of him. Now it looks like he's one of the main contenders he may win. You know, so I think if there's a runoff between the Conservatives and Le Pen, or Macron and Le Pen, it may well be that Le Pen doesn't win, you know, because, well, they have a two-stage presidential election over in France where the two top candidates, if not one doesn't get a majority in the first poll, you get the two top candidates, they have a runoff against each other. So that's probably what will happen, and I think it's, from memory, the first week in May that the result of the second stage of the French presidential election will take place.
Yeah, well, getting over to, say, North Korea, what's going to happen there? It looks like that both sides are painting themselves into corners where they can't do anything but go to war. What do you think?
Well, I notice also that we've had both the Chinese and the Russians are taking this very seriously.
Yes.
Bringing in six-figure sums of troops up towards the border to the north of North Korea. I mean, it does make you wonder if there could be some kind of false flag there, George, you know, because it wouldn't take a lot to trigger that. And we've got a... I won't call Kim Jong-il a maniac, because he is, in a way, you can understand why he feels under such pressure. Looking back at the original Korean War, you know, from 1950 to 1953, a lot of people still remember that in North Korea. You know, there was an absolutely horrific number of casualties, something like 100,000 killed and wounded, or 200,000 killed and wounded, which worked out around about, let me just get these figures right. Around about 250,000 wounded and about 200,000 killed in North Korea during those 3 years. So, you know, as against, I think it was about 33,000 US and South Korean troops. Because it was the carpet bombing that did it, George. The cities in North Korea were absolutely wiped out by carpet bombing, by incendiary bombs, that meant that they had fires that were burning for weeks in the cities of North Korea. So they are understandably a little bit nervous about restarting the Korean War, whereas it seems that President Trump and the US are kind of a little bit more blasé about it. Now, we all know that sometimes what they say is just talk, it's just done to frighten people, just to scare people, but I mean, this is no responsible way to to do diplomacy. In fact, it seems diplomacy is not anywhere. You know, we've got the 750 bases, the famous 750 US bases in, you know, various different parts of the world. I wonder how many bases the North Koreans have got in other parts of the world. Are they need to be that much of a threat? And I tell you what, if the US, because of course the US is bringing in these missiles into South Korea too. I mean, imagine what would happen if the North Koreans were bringing their ballistic missiles into to Canada, George, you know.
Yeah.
This is what we've got to look at. This is what the way they see things, and so they're getting very, very nervous. I would also suggest that the source of the nuclear weapons of the North Koreans should be looked at very, very closely, because my sources indicate that they are probably, they bought them on the black market through the various arms dealers that would sell these things, but they were originally from South Africa, because in the 1990s, when you went over to black majority rule in South Africa, South Africa with Israel had a joint nuclear weapons program,
right,
and had been developing nukes. And when it came to black majority rule, these kind of, I suppose, racist white AWB types said, well, we don't want the black people to get hold of these, you know, the ANC. We don't want the black majority rule people to get. So they decided we're going to sell them on the black market and make a few bob. And so I think that's one of the sources, anyway, of the North Korean nuclear weapons is actually via the Conservative Party. And David Cameron being involved in that deal back in 1992, before he was became Prime Minister or even an MP, and various arms dealers. The name John Bredenkamp comes to mind. Sir Kenneth Warren from the Conservative Party is one of the funders of that possible deal. And you'll see that there are several articles around on the internet which suggest that this was basically a way of raising a bit of money for a Tory general election campaign, selling these nuclear weapons on the black market. So, you know, if there's any truth to that, I'd like to see the various characters involved arrested and that exposed, because handing over nuclear weapons to the North Koreans seems like a bit of a reckless move.
Right. What concerns me is one of the things in that area is Fukushima is very vulnerable to attack. And if the North Koreans came in there with a submarine or something, they could cause havoc in, because of Fukushima's existing a meltdown, you know, three of them, you know?
Well, I mean, I don't know if you've been reading these. Some interesting, Jeff Rentz has some interesting reports. I don't know, you know, quite what the veracity of them is. One of the things he's been saying recently is that he believes that the contamination from Fukushima is far worse than the people are being told, that the contamination of the Pacific around there,
yeah,
and parts of Southeast
it
Asia
is
actually far worse than anyone's being told, and also that some of the US ships that have been in the area have themselves become contaminated, and they go back, they chug back over to San Diego, I guess it would be, and come into port, and all the little alarm bells go off saying this is a radioactive ship you've got here, you know, that you've been sailing a bit too close.
Steve Simmons came off the USS Ronald Reagan, and we flew him in on our second. I had two Fukushima conferences in Austin in 2014. I couldn't even get the Japanese Americans in Austin to support me. But anyway, I brought him in. He was on there and got debilitated by a plume of plutonium. So, USS Reagan and the Nimitz both got contaminated.
Amazing. Well, look, and also there are suggestions that the Fukushima site was being used by the Japanese illegally
to prepare
nuclear weapons.
There was a plutonium cache there, storage.
Now, they would probably say that the plutonium was for the fast breeder reactors
but
they're not fast breeder reactors.
There was a secret, according to rumors, okay, now this, we're talking about rumors, was old man Bush, when he was president, struck a special deal with the Japanese to start a nuclear weapons program in Japan. And I think that's probably possibly true. I'm not sure.
Well, and I think the Japanese would certainly be used in South Korea as well, because they seem to be a kind of cat's paw for the US in that part of the world, a bit like the Americans used to talk about the Australians as our sheriff, you know, down in Australasia.
Right. The Japanese and the Koreans have been enemies anyway for centuries, you know, and so they're not, you know, friends, so to speak.
No. Well, I mean, it's, you know, and also, of course, the Chinese will be looking at this very carefully, you know, especially with all the history between China and Japan over the time.
So
you know, some more tension there. But, I mean, I think, in a way, coming back to the UK, I think, you know, this general election is going to be really an interesting, you know, we still, I think, Britain have probably more influence than people realise on what happens in world events. And when we've got a decent government here in Britain, as we as ordinary English people, British people, are working at. I mean, we've got some pretty awful parties around, like the Scottish National Party. The power has gone completely to their head in Scotland. They are quite good on a socialist tip, that is to say, making sure that, you know, that there are jobs for people, these kind of priorities, that people have got a reasonable income, a roof over their head, these basic things, without obsessing about massive amounts of tax and really impoverishing the middle classes, that kind of thing. They're quite good. But they're just obsessed with the idea of a love-in with Brussels, which actually the Scottish people don't want. The evidence is that if Britain was to go through with this whole Brexit programme, and we were to separate completely from Brussels after 2 years, that the Scottish would be much more likely to stay as part of the United Kingdom. And the Scottish National Party just simply don't get this. They have no inkling of an understanding that actually that's what the Scottish people want. And they are wedded. I mean, for example,